Hi, welcome back to Day in the Literature Anthropologist Life. Today we have a special guest, Sarah. How are you, Sarah?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this awesome podcast where we learn what it means to be a digital anthropologist for a day. I'm very excited because I mean these questions keep coming and I love it. Just to understand what it means, so what it means to be an anthropologist in the virtual spaces. So walk me through your typical wake up time and what does your morning routine looks like as a digital anthropology?
So my day, I work hybrid, so there are some days where I'm on campus and some days where I'm not on campus. So that really determines like what time I wake up. I'm usually up by 7, give or take, 6:30 if I have to like commute because I don't trust public transit to get me anywhere on time. Love having the option of taking public transit because I don't have a car, but it's every so often it's just like, oh, we're just like canceling 3 buses in a row, so figure it out. But I always try to log on like right at 9. And I try to take my mornings pretty slow. It takes me a while to get out of bed because it's just like so comfortable. But yeah, usually I just like get up, get ready, wash my face, get dressed, make myself some toast and have some coffee, especially if I'm working from home. Boot up my computer and see what I have to do for the day. And my tasks are always different. There's never really like a standard day. A lot of times I'll have like underlying projects and tasks I have to complete, and then always like being alert for the next thing that comes up that I have to do and shifting gears. But yeah, I'm not really a morning person, so my morning routine is very very minimal, just like whatever it takes to get me out the door or get me online.
That's great. Yeah, everybody has, seems to have like a different routine and a way of the transition through the day. So what are you working freelance right now? You working for a company or for a government?
I work for Harvard Business School. I'm a research associate.
Oh, that's nice. And
Yeah.
so what is like the title of your duties that you have to do?
It really depends on what the professor I work for needs me to do. So a lot of the time it will be doing research for her, finding sources for like the front-end literature review of the paper she's writing. For a while I was coding qualitative research and interviews. Currently trying to get myself acclimated with Excel and massive databases that, excuse me, is something new that I'm learning and, working slash struggling my way through, making sure everything is in line and perfect. But yeah, it really depends. Sometimes I'll sit in on meetings for her if she can't make them and make sure that everything, that there's notes on everything. And yeah, my job, like actual outline title, is pretty much just supporting her in any research that she needs.
Wow, that's it has to be very interesting to be able to research all kinds of virtual spaces or whatever topic she might be doing research. So the next question will be like, how do you keep your skills sharp, stay up to date with the latest developments in digital anthropology? Are there any specific practices of training you engage in daily?
So my main way of keeping up with digital anthropology, because my job requires some of it, but it's not specifically like digital anthropology oriented, is a lot of following people on LinkedIn or keeping up with conferences or things that are going on. A lot of keeping up with research Substacks, people write about like what they're doing on there. For my own practices, I always like to have like a side project going on, because that keeps me sharp and keeps me involved in the spaces that I used to be involved in, the research I used to be involved in, back when I was in like grad school and undergrad. So my graduate project or thesis focused on biphobia on this platform, Tumblr. It's a pseudonymous social media platform. It was really popular in the 2010s. But because it's pseudonymous, you never really know who you're talking to or who's saying what. So there's a lot of like, oh, well, this person said something, but who is this person? Are they just a troll? Are they trying to, just be mean to be mean? Or is this what someone genuinely is feeling? But because you don't know, there's a interesting underlying assumption that everyone's being genuine. And on that space, I was looking at inclusionist and exclusionist discourse, which is pretty much like who is actually LGBTQ plus and how can we decide and where are we drawing the boundaries and how are these working in these digital communal spaces and so on and so forth. And that was really interesting, especially when looking at like, how people are functioning in these spaces and what does it even mean to like be a, I guess, netizen of Tumblr, and as like a younger queer person, what does that look like? So because that was my undergraduate and master's research, I've done like a personal shift to looking at how within the bisexual community on online, not exclusively Tumblr, but generally online, how they describe like inclusion and exclusion within their own like sphere of influence, essentially.
Wow, I Tom remember Tumblr. They still probably have it, but it's not as common as it used to be back on like the early 2010s, 2009. I remember, but I used to more like look into see memes more.
Yeah.
They have like an active community. I feel like the new version of Tumblr is Reddit or Quora
Yeah. No, I would say it's either
or Discord.
Reddit or like Instagram in a weird way. TikTok kind of, because you people like self-sort into their little communities. But it's not the same like pseudonymous way as like Tumblr used to be. Like Reddit is very anonymous.
Yeah, and you get to discover and immerse yourself in different like groups and subgroups, and it's a rabbit hole. You can like literally live through like understanding and observing all these like communities that sometimes you are part of those communities too because you have interested. For example, I admit that I'll go through makeup hang or like empties of makeup. I can stay on that group forever. But it's at the same time, it's interesting understanding, how that dynamic works.
Yeah.
What kind of projects are you currently working on? And could you walk us through a typical project from start to finish? Excuse me.
Yeah, so I'm currently working on two projects, one on race and class within companies. And that one was started before I started working at Harvard Business School. My professor had already had that like in the work, so a lot of that is just some coding data, getting some stuff uploaded, and moving things around. And then the one I'm currently working on is a tech-enabled DEI project, which is looking at companies that have like technology that's meant to like eliminate bias within the employee life cycle. So they're like, we have a product and it will help you diversify your workforce, or it will provide like venture capital funding for minority began like businesses. And we're basically looking at what type of approach are these companies taking to their like process. Is it like developmental? They want to like get to know the person. It's more holistic. It's very like involved in that way. Or is it more like transactional? It's like, oh, well, we got to meet a quota. So, just like stats and numbers and meeting it this way. Or is it like skill-based, where it's like, well, what skills do you have and how can it help with us, or how can we build your skills? And then seeing if they take more of a approach that's focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or more of like a people analytics HR-ish more approach. So we're working on an academic paper and a white paper for that.
Wow. So when you started doing that research, or that approach to research, did you had any specific skills that you have to train separately from what you were taught in grad and undergrad, or
Oh yeah, Excel. Excel data management, in a way that I haven't previously done. So a lot of my data collection previously was basically one big Word document because it was all Tumblr posts, and I would code them that way through just massive Word documents. And I was like, that was fine for me because it was like, oh, I'm the only one working on this. I don't have like a team behind me. But now it's a bunch of Excel documents and then various Excel documents that get sent out to people. And I'll be the first to say, like, it's been a learning curve. It continues to be a learning curve for how to handle just like rows and rows and columns of data and make sure things don't get like twisted or where they aren't meant to be. Excel and I have a love-hate relationship, but yeah, that's pretty much a skill that I've had to trial by fire. It's getting better. It's getting better. It's just one of those things where it's like, oh, this is like all new and this is different and it's a little bit hard, but it's manageable and like interesting.
Yeah, totally. I get it. Same with me. I have to basically self-taught a lot of new avenues and new topics when I decided to become a digital anthropologist. But yeah, Excel, it's an interesting. I think every anthropologist has like a kind of love and hate relationship because we're technically not trained on that. We know research methods, we have cultural experience, but not like such a intense training. I mean the basics is easy, but when you get into like you're mentioning the sorting all the amounts of data, it can get complicated. So yeah, if whoever's listening and want to pursue Sarah's path, make sure you take if you're undergrad or grad school, make sure you take like what's it called, in an elective Excel that can help
Yeah.
you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or just find courses online and figure it out. It's definitely quantitative methods were something that I didn't learn a lot in undergrad or grad school because my project was very qualitative focused. So quantitative like has been trial by fire, essentially. Which is fine. Like, it's okay. It's just one of those things where it's like every so often I'm like, I just really need a win here, but everything's just numbers and spreadsheets, and I'm just like, it's a slog, but it's okay. I'll come out the other end somehow.
And our next question, we kind of related to what we're talking, is like, how do you approach your research, and can you share any unique methodologies or tools that you use?
Yeah, so my approach to my research is different from like my day job and then like my passion research. So my day job is very much I follow the lead of my boss. So however she wants us to find things recently, it's been doing analysis through ChatGPT and seeing what the AI has to say. And being like, well, ask that for suggestions or whatever. And I was like, okay, I'll ask that. And then moving on, figuring it out and like sorting everything from there. Which has been interesting. It's been something. Then my own personal methodology. It sounds a little silly to say, but it's very like organic. I'm more of the type of person to, excuse me. I'm more of the type of person to just go like, okay, I need to find something along here, and then I'll do like along about this, and then I'll do a keyword search on whatever platform I'm on. Let's say Reddit for the sake of this, and I'll be like, well, I want to know what people are saying about like, how do you know if you're in the bisexual community, or how do you know when you're bisexual? Like, what is a stereotype of bisexual people? And I'll start like keyword searching that either like generally in the search engine or like in specific subreddits. And then I'll just like scroll and screenshot. Because I work on pseudonymous platforms, there are some ethical concerns, but fewer ethical concerns than something with people's like full name and face. That's the one thing that, I would tell digital anthropologists generally, keep up with your IRBs on that, especially if you're in school, because I learned that apparently my master's thesis didn't count as research because I wasn't talking to people or I wasn't interacting with them directly. So I didn't need an IRB. But I was told in my undergrad that because I was taking people's like personal data, that I would need an IRB. So I had like a semi weird IRB that was like, I can't collect like name and age, which I also couldn't verify. Because on Tumblr, you put whatever you want. You don't even have to be 13. Back in my day, you didn't even have to be 13. You just had to sit, check the box that said you were 13. And I don't know who would have checked. I mean, I was like 14 when I started my blog. So I was fine. But I know some people were like, oh, I started mine when I was 11. And I just said, yeah, I was 13. But there's like no way to verify someone's age because to sign it up, you only need like an email, username, and a password, which is literally the bare minimum to have an account. I do try to take like a lot of ethical concerns into like what I'm doing because I know that people, especially if you're looking at like Instagram or TikTok, there are a lot of concerns over, oh, people are posting their face. What are they doing if they're like, posting, I don't know, like they're saying their location, their name, and their age, and all this like personal data. And I'm like, I, you know, because of IRB stuff and ethical concerns, like I'm not going to use the information from minors because that's a protected class. And that I don't want to, you know, just like steal someone's data. Like that's, I'm not Facebook.
Now
But
through the whole Cambridge Analytica all over again.
yeah. So it's very much a lot of like coding specifically to like, you know, alter usernames. Like I will always say, like, if I can't find their information like just on Google on a public Tumblr account or on a public Reddit, I'm not using it because I have to sign into my account to find your stuff. And that means like someone else would have to sign in. That means it's not like easy, not easily available, but it's not like popular enough to gain that type of like, if I Google it, it will show up in the first result. So I did put a lot of like caps around like, oh, I'm not going to include a post with less than like 10,000 likes, reblogs, comments, interactions, or whatever, because someone with like two likes, that's, you know, not statistically significant enough to be like, this is something that a lot of people have seen that there would be discussion around. Reddit's a little bit different. Usually it is like, you know, it's already public, so there aren't a lot of like, oh, this is a completely private. There are private like subreddits, but there aren't like a lot of them. So if generally I can find them, that's a different situation, but I try to focus on like what garners the most attention, what the most people are talking about, and stuff like that.
Wow, that's very interesting, you know, for someone who has no knowledge that, you know, anthropologists actually, you know, we tend this is the new way of doing ethnography or participant observation work through digital spaces and virtual places. It's very fascinating to see how an anthropologist, trained anthropologist is, you know, approaching this work. And yeah, that was actually one of my, you know, questions, ethical considerations. But then, you know, you're already answering it.
Yeah.
So,
Now, ethical considerations are something that I spend a lot of time thinking about, especially with my own digital footprint, because like all my personal accounts are private. I don't really have any interest in being an influencer or having my entire life broadcasted online. That's not something I'm like itching for. I'm not like I need this. I want the brand deals. But I think it's very, it has to be considered the line between influencer and then everyday person, because an everyday person could have like one thing that blows up online, like one TikTok that goes absolutely viral, and the rest of theirs could just be like three people watch it. But like, how do you handle the this one went viral and is now on like the Today Show and like it's being reposted to Instagram and like whatever, versus oh, they do have like all this other content, but I personally wouldn't feel comfortable sifting through someone's personal life like that. Even if they did have like one viral moment, I would be like, you know, there should be a focus on the viral moment versus like day in my life, let's go get boba with my friends. Like I feel like there has to be some type of line in the sand drawn somehow, and I don't know exactly what the best way to do that is. I'm just kind of following what I've been taught about IRB stuff and like general ethical considerations, and also I guess the golden rule, treat people the way you would want to be treated. And I would, if I had a public account and I went viral for one thing, I would really hate for someone to be like, back in 2012, Sarah posted a picture of this snake and we're including this in our data set because she posted it. And I'd be like, I don't know. I was like in high school. I posted a picture of a snake I saw outside. Like,
yeah, sometimes like the internet tends to exemplify or like zoom something that you didn't thought that was gonna be, but then how do you handle it? You know, what's the repercussions later on in life? And for the people who's not familiar, what does IRB stands for?
Internal review board, it's basically ethical. I believe it's internal review board. Is it it's either internal or international? I think it's internal. I always just call it IRB. It's basically like ethical considerations for your research. So if you're working with human subjects, then you have to explain the pros and cons of working them, any dangers they may or trauma they may encounter during your research, like basically exactly what your methods are and what you plan to collect, how you plan on storing them. And how you're going to anonymize or m maintain like protection for the people, for the identity of the people you're working with. And some people have a lot longer IRB processes than others. As I said, my master's one, I turned in an IRB and they're like, this isn't research. And I was like, oh, well, cool.
Yeah.
I got really no explanation on that. There's like, this doesn't count federally as research. And I was like, okay, can
Oh,
I
wow.
still get my master's degree?
Yes. Right. And then our next question is like with community engagement, how do you interact with online communities and what role do you use community plays in your research? And I know you mentioned a lot of it right now already. Is there anything you would like to add?
Yeah, so I'm actually the type of person who kind of I love interacting with online communities, but I prefer lurking, if that makes sense. I really just like watching what people have to say. Partially because, at least with my master's undergrad research, I didn't want to disturb an already existing environment by going in and being like, I need you to explain why you're saying X, Y, and Z to me. Like, I couldn't really contact these people. I couldn't, go up to them and be like, hey, I know you're, I don't know, like Rainbow Sparkle 45 on Tumblr. And if that's actually your username, I'm so sorry. I just made something up. And you said that all bisexual women who have had relationships with men can't be queer because they've already submitted their mind, body, and soul to the male patriarchy. And again, if that's your username and you don't believe that, I'm so sorry. But like, I can't be like, and when you say that, what do you mean by that? Also, who are you and can I set up an interview? Like, that's not happening, partially because of the limits of my research and what I was aiming to achieve, partially because the blog could be dead. It could be someone who stopped posting, they, got locked out of their account and they never made a new one. And now whatever they were saying is just stuck on there forever. Or it could be a minor who was just saying whatever they wanted, and I wouldn't know because they put their age is none of your business in their little like blog description. So I really don't, at least for those two things, I really tried my best to not interfere. It was very much a historical analysis of what I was seeing from like the 2010s and also like a current analysis of what's happening. Lately, at least for my research, I still don't really comment. I feel like that's one of my things. I'd rather see what other people are saying than start being like, oh, here's my internal bias. Like, I don't think it's fair that the stereotype for bisexual people is that they cuff their jeans because I don't cuff my jeans because I don't like how it feels. But like, that's, excuse me again. Almost feel unimportant. Like I have my own stuff I'm going to write and how I'm going to write about it. And, I probably will say in my paper, if cuff jeans is a symbol of bisexuality, it makes it seem like people who don't cuff their jeans can't be bisexual. And why are we like the stereotypes exist, but how about we defy the stereotypes? So yeah, a lot of mine is like more lurking. There are some like online communities I do interact with and I do comment in, but at least for my research, I try to keep it more on either, viral moment historical posts and how they have like evolved over time, or just observing what people have to say. I find that's a lot more
Participant
interesting.
observation. That's your thing.
It would be nice to like kind of like get in and like talk to people, sure, but there are still just like, there are other people like me who are just watching this happen online and not saying anything. And what's the positionality of the person who's just watching this and not engaging in it?
Right. That's true. Sometimes, like, either either there to participate or be part of the tribe, what we call the virtual tribe, or you're there, with a specific agenda to just understand better certain communities. So I think that also depends on what's what are you thinking about doing. Like sometimes like say I will participate on the Reddit because it's something that is on my personal time and it's something that I enjoy. I do it as a satisfaction and something that is fun for me to do, like wash makeup, stuff like that, right? But sometimes you're like trying to understand virtual communities, trying to understand like what is the point of these people posting their empty plastic containers of the empty makeup. Like, what is it? But you try to under, but you're seeing that this is a theme going on that understands, like, so what makes it, like, what makes these people come together and discuss about, you know, this piece of lipstick emptying, what it makes difficult, you know, understand, like, reviews and stuff like that. So I think, you know, it's really interesting topic, whether you're doing there as a, you know, personal hobby or doing as a research. So what are some of the biggest challenges you face in your work, and how do you overcome them?
A great question. I think one of the biggest challenges is the how quickly the digital landscape changes, because I've noticed that over time, like the lifespan or of memes is so much shorter, and the lifespan of like conversations that are happening will be like hours instead of like a week or two. And part of that, it's hard to overcome because I have a full-time job, but I'm not paid to scroll Twitter as much as I would like to be. My dream job is just like lurking on the internet. But you can't pay rent just like scrolling Reddit, and at least not yet. Maybe one day. Digital curation would be an interesting job. I digress. But it's basically figuring out like, I guess playing detective and just like going through and going back through comments and through threads and figuring out where did this begin. You know, once I clock off of work and I'm like, okay, time for passion projects, like being like, oh, I missed an entire day's worth of, you know, people being biphobic online. So now I have to go and back and handle all of that. And, you know, go back through and find different things and hope that it's still there and that no one has a private account or no one privated their account. And that's tough. That's tough. Overcoming that is a lot of just kind of accepting that you can't have everything. I feel like that's was very hard when I began digital anthropological research, where I was like, but if I don't have everything, then I can't like, you know, make like say what I need to say. And it's like, well, maybe you just won't have everything. Maybe someone changed their username or deleted their blog and you just like won't get this anymore. Which is sad because, you know, we run the risk of going into like a digital black age where information previously online is no longer there. Or, you know, shows that were up for streaming are no longer available. And that sucks. I have a lot of feelings about, you know, the importance of digital archives. But yeah, I think also, at least in my research, the mental health aspect is something that has to be dealt with. Plenty of psychologists have said that staring at screens all day definitely is not good for you. My job and my passion is staring at screens, which also sounds weird to say. And yeah, it's when I finished my master's degree, I actually had to take a step back from researching biphobia online. It just took too much out of me. It was impacting my like interpersonal relationships. It was impacting the way I interacted with the world. I just couldn't do it. I was going to therapy and like discussing, you know, I spent 4 years re reading all these hateful comments online, and now I don't know how to like, you know, not do that. It was tough. So I did have to like take a step back and, you know, regroup, reevaluate, and then pretty much decide, you know, this is still something I care about. And maybe I can't go forward and make this like a PhD or something. And that's not going to happen. And maybe this is like a project that I have to, you know, put and keep on the back burner as just something I casually care about, but I can't obsess over. And yeah, I feel like definitely self-care is important, especially depending on the spaces you research, like any. If you're researching hate groups, you should be in therapy. Not because you're doing that, but just for what you're reading.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. It takes a lot, you know.
Yeah, it takes a lot. And I wasn't even researching hate groups. It was just people being mean to each other all the time. Especially as a bisexual person, it was just difficult to be like, oh, I'm supposed to read all of this, then go into queer spaces and pretend like I didn't read any of that. Or that there aren't people out here like saying horrible things online about bisexual people and other people in the LGBTQ community. It was just really, it was just hard to give myself that like mental separation. And I do think, especially depending on your research, it's needed. It's okay to take a step back if it's overwhelming. Like, as I said, it's tough to not have all the information, but it's also tough to spend hours on hours every day looking at horrible things just constantly. And even if you aren't researching horrible things, if you're researching like, makeup communities, which in my mind is not is like not something that I would cry to my therapist over. Or maybe it could be, I don't know. Like, it's still important to take breaks, and you're still allowed to step back from it for like a day or two. You're allowed to take the weekend. And sure, maybe you'll miss something, but there's always going to be more. Like, unless, the group you're looking at disbands in 12 hours, and it just so happens to be the 12 hours that you were, taking care of yourself. Like, that would suck, but you're still like, you're allowed to look away.
Yeah, that's true. No, mental health is something that needs to be talked within our industry, because we spend a lot of that's your job, to spend time on the screen observing whatever virtual community or whatever thing that has, you are researching on online. It's something that you really have to take seriously in consideration and see, draw the line when it's taking over your life, and how do you create like a balance, output, or to have like a real life going outside, walking, spending time with your loved ones. And also, how do you still have your personal time online without you crossing those boundaries and trying to still continue to do the work when it's your personal time and shouldn't be like going into, your research spaces that you're supposed to be, studying. Yeah, that was one of the questions, and that it was like, you can, how do you navigate it? How do you maintain your work life in a field that is so deeply connected with the digital world? But you mentioned that. And then
Sorry, I'm getting ahead of you on the questions. It's just all so
yes,
interconnected.
thank you. So what is the best advice you have received that helped you in your career? And what advice would you give someone interested in the digital anthropology?
See, that's tough because I am early in my career. I only got my master's degree in 2022, so it's only been 2 years out from it. So I know if I would have a lot of like sage advice. But I think one thing that did stick with me that helped me a lot is that if you study digital anthropology, you're a digital anthropologist. And there, I had a lot of imposter syndrome around that. Like, it was very much a question of like, when can I call myself a digital anthropologist? When can I say this is what I do? This is important to me. I know some people who are like, well, you need a more advanced degree than a bachelor's to be able to like claim the title of anthropologist, because otherwise, anyone can get an undergrad anthropology degree, which, isn't true. There are financial barriers and like all of that stuff. So not just like anyone can get one, and if you don't like it, you aren't going to get one. But that was something like after my master's, I was like, can I call myself that? Like, I don't have a PhD, but there are plenty of people with PhDs in anything that like or don't work in the field and still call themselves that. So if you study digital anthropology, you're a digital anthropologist. I with a degree, without a degree, however it works for you. That got rid of a lot of imposter syndrome for me, of feeling like, anything I have to say doesn't matter because I, don't have a PhD, or I haven't been in the field for 30 years, which like there wouldn't be a field 30 years ago. Like there was no Tumblr 30 years ago. It just didn't exist. But yeah, I think that was something that really helped me. And career-wise, try things out. I think an issue that I notice a lot within anthropology is people being like, oh, well, I didn't learn any skills for the workplace. And it's like, yeah, you did. You did. It just might not be like, I learned SQL and here's my portfolio of SQL projects. And, if you did learn SQL, good for you. I'm working on it. But Yeah.
You can always acquire the skill, you know. You don't have to go to a fancy university to
You
study
can
it.
always upskill. Upskilling's a thing. Like, no one's gonna stop you from upskilling. I mean, they might, but I doubt it.
I couldn't agree more with what you said right now. I myself, I don't have a graduate or PhD for personal reasons. I was looking into it, but one of the reasons, like, we don't have a specific digital anthropology curriculum in the US. So that means you
No.
have to travel abroad, like London, USC, or Australia, and Europe, and life happens. You just can't be, you know, doing for personal reasons. And it shouldn't be everybody's business, you know, why you have not got what you
Or
have
you
got.
have to DIY it because,
Exactly. And you can become a digital anthropologist. It's just doing, you know, doing your thing. If it's your passion, like me, I decided to upscale and specialize myself in different areas like data science, artificial intelligence, and it's a constantly learning. I'm constantly like whatever course or class or talk or event or conference or moment to network with someone who can help me get better on my craft. I think, I mean, you don't have to have a PhD title to have an like good research and create, you know, group, call yourself a digital anthropologist. So I totally agree on that
Yeah.
second with you. Okay, so the other one is like, what do you find most rewarding about your role as a digital anthropologist?
I feel like it's twofold. One fold is very much like it's nice to sometimes feel like the smartest person in the room about like a specific digital phenomenon. Because a lot of people like know about it, but then when you'd be like, oh, well, you know. I've traced this type of biphobia online back to like conversations happening in the 60s and 70s, and like how these are like evergreen discussions that are going on, and how like they've been answered. And but the new generations come online and they're having these same questions. So then, you know, we have to consider how do you educate the youth that there are these conversations that are happening online, and that's some of their like queer elders have answered the question or they've already had this, and that you're joining a larger like zeitgeist of ideas than just like I'm the first person to come up with bisexual men are secretly gay. Like I'm the first one to come up with this negative stereotype, which like you aren't. Like these things have been discussed like ad nauseum for decades. So that's kind of my own personal thing as I like being able to be like, oh well actually like if you look at it deeper than X, Y, and Z in these communities. And then also I feel like it's just really satisfying. I'm like a puzzle person. I like cracking like codes or feeling like I figured stuff out. Like I don't know, when I was 7, I really wanted to be a spy. So I guess this kind of scratches that like I want to find out the information. I want to dig deep. I want to like see all of this. And that's just really satisfying. Like feeling like you got to the bottom of something and you understood like why it's happening, the key players, and what does this mean moving forward. Like it's just satisfying to feel like I figured it out. I cracked the case. Like.
It's totally fascinating. And sometimes it can get, like I say, out of hand. That's why we know one of the questions was like, how do you balance life? Because when you're suddenly passionate and you love it and you keep doing the research, you can go literally 4 hours or two without eating or doing anything
Oh,
and
yeah.
immerse yourself in that, you know, virtual space to the full extent. And, you know, sometimes you kind of have to like have a boundary and be like, okay, remember, this is just a job. You have to work from this, and then, you know,
Yeah, my
go
screen time was really bad for a while there.
to
It was terrible. It was like 19, 18, 19 hours on my
Yeah, especially with the pandemic, that's when I really started immersing myself profoundly on the virtual spaces that I was, you know, researching. And yeah,
Yeah, I
it's
started my master's in 2020. So, I will say I think that was partially a contribution to why I felt so burnt out of digital anthropology and digital spaces by the end, because I didn't have I had a community. I was living with my parents at the time, but I didn't have like other academics to be like, okay, well, you know, people aren't saying these negative things about you specifically. Like, here's how you can take a step back. I didn't always feel like I had that mentoring about like you can separate, like, you know, here is the thing, and then here is like you and your personal life and your own like degree. Like it's still you're allowed to give it space. Which isn't to like, you know, knock on my master's program at all. I think it was just partially the pandemic and not being able to be in person with people and have the sort of like early career guidance that I might have been able to have if I was in person my first year and not, you know, on Zoom.
I also think like all the curriculums are not fully, I don't want to say this word, but fully equipped or what it means to be doing researching, staring at your screen basically 24 hours. We still have not discovered, I mean, all the schools have, you know, put in place kind of, I will say, procedures, or they don't even know themselves, you know, what would be the correct approach. I think we all are discovering as we go. We're creating, you know, research methods, techniques as we go, as we do the research. Because again, this field is relatively new in a way. So yeah, I think we are pioneering one way or another, and especially since technology is evolving so fast, so quick, and every second you can't really be up to date with everything that's going on online, because every second is it's evolving. Okay,
Yeah, I
so
also feel like there are some programs, especially the ones very much rooted in older anthropologic theory, that can feel really constraining for digital anthropologists. I had that some of that issue in my bachelor's, where it was like, okay, great, you're trying to innovate. How can we root this back to like Foucault? And I'm like, we can. And we can root it back to like, you know, the stuff of the 1800s, but you have to concede that like this is a community. And I felt like that was an issue that I kind of butted heads with some people against, about being like, no, this is a community of people. This is a group of people with similar interests. Like, they aren't in the same space. They may never be in the same space. I mean, I have a friend I met in 2016 on Tumblr who I've never met in person, and we still talk like
But you
every.
create that connection, and that's what, you know, the well, now I feel like they have more open-minded, but it's like it's a connection that you created. It's a tribe, online, a virtual tribe that you were drawn for a reason. You know, you share the same likes, the same passions, the same singer, and you created like a bond, a virtual bond. So
I feel like the pandemic was very much a turning point for that, because then people had to be online and had to. I'm not fond of phrasing it this way, but this is the best way I can think of the moment. They had to concede the point that online, that virtual communities are communities, and that was like that. That was interesting for me, about having going from the person at my undergrad where everyone was just like, oh, well, you know, digital research, like you're just like scrolling the internet, you aren't actually looking at communities, and like this is kind of like a passion project disguised as a math as a undergraduate thesis, to them being the person where people were like, hey, I need to know how you did your methods, because my students now can't do in-person research, so how did you do virtual research? And I was like, a few months ago you were telling me that this isn't a community, and now you're like, I have to concede the point, which is fine. Like, you know, I love people changing their minds and evolving, but I just feel like, especially if you are in a program that's more traditionally like theoretically centered, it might just be something that you butt up against. I know that especially helped for me being able to say like, it's anthropology and it's women's gender and sexuality studies, because having the women's gender and sexuality studies department sort of tacked onto it, kind of gave me a little bit more theoretical leeway with some more like updated ideas of community and digital queerness and et cetera. But it was a little bit of a, sometimes it felt like pulling teeth by being like, I have updated theories, and you're like, well, you have to root it back to stuff from the 1950s. And it can be hard to like, you know, make sure you're explaining it the right way, because there are connections, but having like a good support for like advisors or people you're working with is critical, even if they aren't digital anthropologists. My undergraduate thesis advisor, he was not a digital anthropologist, but he saw the value in my work, and he saw like where this could go, and that helped like leaps and bounds like get me to where I am today, by having someone's be like, you know, I might not understand it, I might have never used Tumblr, I might not have experienced any of this, but I believe that you're seeing something and that there's something there.
Yeah, that's totally true. I have felt like you say, with the pandemic, that like opened a whole new door for the anthropology industry in general. And I think we've seen some changes, but I feel that there's so much to do. And I feel it's our duty to create a blueprint for the next generation, especially us digital anthropologists. You know, we're basically pioneers. We're going through a forest with an axe opening a pathway. That's the best way I can describe it. And then I think we're in the right path, you know, with you're doing that such an amazing work on virtual spaces, you know, on Tumblr, with the biophobia. And then I specialize in selling platforms, and everybody has unique and amazing work and research that they're working on that I think this is literally gonna, you know, revolutionize the whole digital anthropology world, and it's gonna become more normal. That's more normal. And okay, so my next question is, do you work more independently, or do you often collaborate with other research institutions or communities?
A lot of my work is, at least for my day job, is independent. I do work with some people who are data scientists, and my boss. I would actually like to do more collaborative work with people. I find that sometimes, like, the details I think are important, the details I see are different than the details other people see and that they feel like are important. So I'd really like to do more collaborative work, partially for the giant Excel spreadsheets to make sure that everything is where it needs to be and I'm not the only person staring at it, the world's largest spreadsheet for hours on end. But also because I feel like people approach digital communities differently. And I think that working with people who have different approaches to it, even if you're looking at the exact same thing, yeah, it yields like a lot more success when you're looking at stuff. I have a friend who's not a digital anthropologist, but she's a Tumblr user and she's my best friend. So a lot of times I would send her be like, what do you think about this? And she'd be like, and the part that I was like, this is the most important part of what this person is saying in this poster. This is the most important part of this comment thread. She would be like, no, it's actually this. Like, have you thought about that? And I'd be like, oh, actually, I didn't. I didn't see that as like the critical part of these communities. It's another perspective. I think valuing another person's perspective is always important. To an extent, you know, sometimes their perspective can be straight up bigoted, and then it's not valid. Like, can't be a bigot online and expect to go unchecked. Like, it's
Having a set a pair of set eyes, of eyes, additional eyes can help you maybe see things that you did not see the first time or over.
Yeah, I feel like it could set is I especially have this issue where I'll miss the forest because of one tree. I'll be like, this is the tree. And then someone's like, you're in a forest. And I have to be like, oh, yeah. And maybe that's just my hyper focus where I'm just like narrow in on one thing and you know, you can't do it all. So I focus on the one thing and then someone's like, yeah, you focus on that one train of thought for a while. You miss the rest of the passengers. Like you're still at a train station. Like there's other things. So I feel like sometimes seeing what other people think is the most important part or the thing to be focused on, like it gives me a better perspective on what I thought was the best thing to focus on.
That's right. Correct. Yeah, that always helps, you know, and especially with doing with so much that, again, you know, technology is evolving every second, every moment. So it can be a like overwhelming amount of information out there, and you're trying your best to like source it out. And again, a pair of, you know, an additional set of eyes can help you and easy your path, you know. And then this question, I am adding it because it's very important. When people who's not in digital anthropologists, or they're planning to become digital anthropologists, they're interested. It's like when you're high school, you're researching what do you want to do, whatever path, you know, profession you want to do. So you go online, you go in books, and just try to understand, like, in terms of compensation, like, what can someone expect in terms of compensation when starting out in digital anthropology, and how does that change with experience? That is what I'm asking, because online there is nothing that can say a digital anthropologist starting with a bachelor's degree or whatever the experience is, you can start at 50,000 or $10 an hour, and you know, increases like that. There is no information. So it's very important us to set out like a blueprint for, you know, everybody in general to guide themselves and be able to earn what they deserve for the time and the work they're putting in companies. And, you know, sometimes companies can take advantage of this because there is not any information out there. So I think it's very important.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I will say I can't really speak to, where can you go, because I've graduated my master's and I've been in this at the same job. But I will say that from my understanding of when I was when I look for jobs or just generally peruse, LinkedIn to see what people want with anthropologists, I would say earlier in your career, I hate saying this, don't expect a lot of money. I feel like at least in the United States, there in the United States and in my experience, there's a devaluing of social science as like a legitimate career path or a legitimate science. And I think especially with a bachelor's, it might be difficult. For example, when I was looking for a job or when I have looked for jobs, I usually just look at qualitative researcher positions, and that can vary. I've seen jobs from like 35K a year, which is not really livable almost anywhere. Unless, I don't know, someone it might be in like the middle of nowhere, maybe. Or if you like live with your parents, they don't make you pay rent. They might be livable versus, I think a Reddit UX position I saw today was the low end was like 120,000. I started off making a little over 60K when I first started at this position. Hopefully, when my contract ends and if I go on to something else, I'll make more than that. It would be nice, but the job market is also just tough these days, and I know that like it's disheartening to see jobs that want someone with a STEM background and it's still looking for qualitative research and like, yeah, but we want a biologist. It's like, okay. But yeah, I think digital anthropology specifically, I actually don't even know what your starting salary would be as a digital anthropologist. I always, because I have a background in podcasting and a background in social media management, I always look at like communication roles. Because, digital anthropologists combined with I've managed social media accounts combined with I've done communication stuff, it kind of makes sense. And that also is a mixed bag depending on where you live.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel like that was like a non-answer, but also I'm like it's tough to pin down because it also depends on like the areas you live in.
No, it's
And
totally understandable because, you know, sometimes, you know, there is not, that information is not out there. You know, as much as I do my research, I keep seeing, I don't see like a specific number that you can refer to. But you know, with at least, you know, the numbers or the answers that I'm getting from all these amazing, you know, digital anthropologists such as yourself, we can have a starting point, you know, and from there we can go forward and hopefully, you know, be able to put ourselves in a position that a digital anthropologist can start earning what they deserve because we are the total package. I mean, we have on a holistic mind and we have all these research methods and skills and we can understand different worlds and, you know, a translator into just, you know, regular translate into, you know, normal language for people who doesn't understand the world that we like trying to research. So where do you see the field of digital anthropology heading in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I feel this is the answer everyone's going to give, but it's definitely something with AI. This sounds mean. It's every tech bro's favorite shiny toy at the moment. I have my own concerns about AI and my own concerns about the environmental impact of AI mainly, and also the impact on like creativity and creative fields. But I feel like virtual reality spaces too. I know it's like easier to get like a VR headset recently. I think that could be somewhere digital anthropology would be going. I don't know, I'm trying to think of upcoming like social media platforms. I feel like that's definitely like I couldn't when I was writing my undergraduate thesis, I could not have predicted how like big TikTok would have been. And now like if someone said, which social media platform do you think is one of the best to like research? I would say TikTok. like the algorithm and the way that it like feeds you content, absolutely fascinating. Yeah, 5 to 10 years. I feel like it's definitely going. Here's something that here's a prediction I have, because of AI. I think that you're going to see a lot of people who are in AI relationships. I know there are some people who already like have been, like there was a whole few years back, there's a whole issue with the company Replica. It was like an AI chat box bot you could have a relationship with, because they remove the like sexual features from the function. So if you tried to like sex with your AI companion, you weren't able to, and that caused an uproar. But I think that with the rise, like every platform having some kind of AI and people building their own AI like bots, I think there might be a rise in people having relationships with their AI bots rather than other people. And that's definitely a digital anthropology issue. It's not an online community, but it's how are you interacting with this digital technology, and like what does it mean to have a relationship with an AI chat? I'm sorry, I'm laughing because to me it sounds like I could never have a relationship with an AI chat bot, but I'm also like, I could genuinely see that becoming like something that's very popular, and people like posting happy anniversary on their Instagram, Twitter, whatever the new platform is, like happy 1 year anniversary with my chat bot I coded.
Like on Facebook, they used to put in relationship with my chatbot.
Yeah, or like that might maybe in like 20, 30 years it might be normalized. It might just be like, oh yeah, some people are just in a relationship with their chat bot.
Or they have like hybrid lives. We have a real life husband, and a human husband, and we also have a bot husband, and that's
It's
I.
like you're the AI that helps you with work is now your like work husband. It's
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
or something like that. But I feel like with all the AI integration I've seen, especially on phones, I have a feeling that there's some type of human AI relationship that's going to be critical to understand going forward in the next 5 to 10 years. Like there's something along those lines that's going to be like interesting to study or something that should be looked at. I also think like maybe this. I don't exactly know how this would end up being studied, but I think the shift offline would be interesting for digital anthropologists. What is driving people away from social media platforms and social media in general?
There's a cross research on understanding why people are like deciding to leave social media, and some people are just joining and keep going. Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people, usually older than me, who are like, I've done it. I've done the Twitter, the Instagram, the whatever. Like, no one needs to know everything about me anymore. And I see that an interesting shift to that, this idea, like instead of I need to share everything about myself online, it's you don't need to know that. I'm allowed to like have my personal thoughts and feelings that don't need to be on TikTok.
Yeah, I think it's the burnout of having so like massive overwhelming amounts of information having there right here right now, that people like me, I'm a millennial. I'm one of the parts that I'm done with social media. I study social media for a living. But you know, I don't like personally I don't have any, you know, it's the Instagram. I used to have TikTok, but it's just like nah.
Oh, TikTok and I have a toxic relationship.
It's a little too much sometimes, you know, it can affect you.
It's impacted my attention span. Like, I'll be the first person to be like, TikTok has impacted my attention span in the most negative way possible.
And then we're gonna have issues, you know, with kids trying to, like, for example, like I live in Florida. What would happen, like, if we have hurricanes all the time? When the power goes down, there's no internet. So kids are like learning how to interact with human interaction with their parents. How to, hi, I'm your son. Let's talk about something, because
Oh, I see that all the time online where it's like people are like, oh, how do I raise my kids without technology? As they're like on their phone talking to like TikTok about like crowdsourcing advice on how to do this from the internet. And it's just so interesting because like, I grew up in the early 2000s, and like I remember like my first not well, my first smartphone, but also my first like touchscreen device was like borrowing my cousin's original iPod, like iPod Touch, and it was like, You can only use the internet if you're connected to Wi-Fi, and YouTube barely works, and there's no speakers, so you have to have headphones in. And growing up in a w world like that, and now I just carry this with me everywhere.
To the tip of a finger, everything is on your phone.
And I
It's
now work on two screens, and there's a bigger screen that's my TV in the background. It's like, wow.
and it's not
It's
enough because you have an iPad, you have cell phone, you have, oh my God, it's like so many
I have
screens.
an
It's
iPad, I have
not
a cell
enough.
phone, I have a Nintendo Switch. Like, some people's cars have touch screens now, and I'm like,
A
this.
TV, everything is like smart now, like even
The
you
fridge is smart. Like, why does the fridge have to be smart? Like,
That's true. That's true. Now even laundries have like a smart, they're like sensing do your clothes are dry or not. And I'm like, oh my God, this is too much.
I've seen like touchscreen toasters, and I'm like, we're done. We don't need this. Like, we don't need this. And I just think that's really interesting that there's like I remember being told like, oh, you're digital natives. Like you grew up your generation, I'm like older Gen Z. And like you know everything about the internet. And I'm like, sure. But then look at Gen Alpha. Like they were like born with an iPad. Like it just like was there with them. Like it's a little concerning in my opinion, but it's interesting to see where we're gonna go from here. Especially with like younger generations, because I even know that like schools are now doing like phone bans. Like you have to like put your phone in a box for the entire day, and like that's interesting to me because back when I was in high school, it was just like they well your phone should be in your bag away from you, and people just kind of respected that. Versus like I literally cannot not be on my phone.
That's true. Oh, they will confiscate and you go to detention. But it
Yeah.
also arises that the issue with so many shootings going down right now. It's like,
Yeah.
yes, put your phone away or for the entire day, but what happened is some awful situation like that happens, you know.
Yeah.
Don't be able to call 911 or communicate with the parents or record, you know, what's going on. So it's like a sensitive topic, like that it's like, you know, back and forth because, you know, in both sides there are pros and cons. But yeah, that's something that, you know, we'll see how that is gonna evolve. And will you agree that every software should have a digital anthropologist to make ethicals AI more responsible, like having
Yes. And maybe it's a plug, but they should hire me. Sorry.
please hire us?
No, but I feel like a lot of this might seem a little rude. A lot of my disappointment in the tech industry is the fact that they don't take the ethical considerations seriously. And like it's disappointing because it's one of those things where like there are social scientists out here who will discuss the ethics of with you and make sure your product is, on the right track to better society. And instead they're just like, oh, social science is a soft science and not really science. We don't need that. And that's like just disappointing to see with like certain tech products and certain tech companies. But no, I think that especially considering AI and the impact it might have on people, even like software as a service products. Like, how are you storing their data? Like, is this going to be something that like gets out more? Like, how are we handling these questionnaires about, asking people to use your service or even the UX design of it? Like, is it accessible for people with disabilities? Like, do you have a high contrast setting for people with visual disabilities? Does it work with screen readers for those with like auditory disabilities? Like, is it possible to use it with just one hand or do you have to have like a two hands? Like, are we thinking this through to make it like able to be used by everyone. And even like the addictiveness of social media, I feel like a lot of those companies should probably have like digital anthropologists that they can work with and, discuss these concerns. Because you have a platform that went from like a normal platform to then filled with hate groups. What happened? What is in the design of the platform? What is the draw? Like, what happened?
That's
Or
true.
even, managing like what are we going to do if like a hate group joins our site and tries to take over? Like what's the protocol? Where are our values within this? How do we nip this in the bud? Like it's a lot of things to consider. So I do think that tech should look for more digital anthropologists to, research their product. And it is something that I always have said in my when I've applied for jobs, that it's like, you know, I'm applying for like a social media or a communication coordinator position. I will know your platform and your user base better than you think I can, than you think like it's possible. Because like I've studied this. I have like a methodology for how to look at this. I know how do you interact with your how do users interact with each other? How do they interact with the user base? And it's a lot more in-depth than just like metrics. Like it's very holistic. It's very much an understanding of community. So yeah, I do agree.
And this is one of the reasons, you know, I did this, I'm creating this podcast is because when, I don't know if you get this all the time, but when I say I'm a digital anthropologist, I get a blank face. They usually think that I have to deal with Indiana Jones or digging somebody's backyard as an
Yeah.
anthropologist, archaeologist. And I'm like, no, there's so much to it. You know, we study the past, the present, and the future. Right now, mostly we're focusing on the future. And like you were mentioning about, the AI and tech companies. Like, I don't know, you probably watched that documentary, but that's one of the reasons that was around the time that I was forming my nonprofit. It's called The Grey Hack on Netflix. It talks about how the whole issue with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, how, you know, they're stealing your data and they will feed you data specifically towards you. And that's one of the questions that I'm doing research and I'm very passionate about it is like, okay, data is the most important and the most expensive asset that you have, but you don't have a saying on your data. Are you allowed to opt out? What is, and then like all the companies who are collecting this data from all the, you know, things that you have, computers, cell phones, stuff, like what do they do with that data? Who do they sell it for? And the question is, do I have, I mean, not ask permission because it's my data. It's like, can I opt out and not participate in whatever you're doing with my data? Because that's
Yeah.
it's kind of scary and fascinating to see what's going on behind the scenes. So that's one. I will, you know, I don't know if you didn't watch that documentary. I will watch
I
it.
didn't, but I did watch like other stuff about like the
The
addictiveness.
bias with the facial recognition,
Yeah,
social
yeah.
media. I think this is the trilogy that I always recommend when I do my presentations on digital anthropology. On, you know, you need to watch these to understand them because as anthropologists and human is fascinating and very scary at the same time
Oh,
because
yeah.
it's happening in real time. And it's even worse now because that documentary came out on 2019 and it was about the elections of 2016. But, you know, now it's 2024 going to 25, you know, it's even worse, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I also will say that I think it's interesting the way that companies, which I feel is unethical, will hide that they're using your data to feed AI models. Because I remember the other day I was looking at LinkedIn, and I saw someone was like, "Oh, go here to turn off like LinkedIn using your data to feed AI models." And I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to do that. I don't want my data feeding AI models." But also, like, why didn't LinkedIn update me about this? Like,
Exactly.
why did I have to find this out because someone else saw it on their settings page and then turned it off? Like, why wasn't I told like there's an updated terms of an agreement or anything? Like, there was no notification from the company. It was just like sneakily, yeah, I guess if you want to turn it off, you can turn it off, but we aren't going to tell you that we're even doing it.
Yeah,
Which I
I
feel
do
is
like
what
turn
I
off
feel is
my.
personally unethical.
I yeah, it is. There's a lot of things in a lot of these platforms that are unethical, unfortunately, though, you know, we have to sort of use them per se.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of things that needs to be changed. And so my last question for a daily reflection is, at the end of the day, how do you wind down and what do you do to reflect on and after a day of working as a digital anthropologist?
Well, I'm a self-proclaimed workaholic, so I don't really wind down. But let's imagine it's like a Friday because that's the one day I actually can let myself relax. Usually I'll go to the gym, do some yoga, some running. I hate saying that I stare at more screens, but I stare at more screens. I really like movies. So maybe I'll go to the movie theater or I'll watch a TV show. There's a new season of like this trashy reality TV show I love that's coming out soon. So I'm very excited for that. I also do try to get offline. Like I knit and I crochet, and that's something that's very much like, I don't know, you can't scroll TikTok and have something in both your hands while you're doing this. It's difficult. So it is, you know, getting myself offline. So yeah. I don't know. I like taking long showers because, you know, Lush has great products and It's just a nice way to just completely shut down your head. Now I'm thinking about it now. I feel like I really have just like outed myself as not having a standard morning or evening routine. It's really just like go with the flow or whatever I like have time to do. Yeah, I do always make sure that I take Saturdays off. Like I will do nothing regarding work or digital anthropology on Saturdays. That is time for me to get out of my house and do something and not look at screens. And that's really important to me, really being able to be like, you know, maybe Sunday is dedicated to my passion projects and I'm back to looking at screens, but there's at least one day a week where it's like, no, you aren't allowed to sit here and not leave your house and just live online. You have to actually like go into the world and,
That's true. Yeah.
you know,
I actually
be a
do a lot
person.
of digital detox, so I try to, make sure that everything's right for the weekend, so I don't have to use my phone and just turn it off from like Friday 5 p.m. to Monday 8 a.m. It helps a lot, but sometimes it's difficult because you want to be, I mean, you check your bank account, if you have a message from your family that everything's okay, you need Uber, you need so many things that is on your phone. So I think digital detox, it's very important. Or just, and then also, but you have to carry your phone for you with you all the time just in case. That's the problem, because you
Yeah.
have to call an emergency, or just like to have time to just go to TJ Maxx and start sniffing candles because that's therapeutic. So you
Oh
can
yeah,
take your mind
absolutely.
out of,
The new
what.
fall collections,
Oh
amazing.
yeah. I'm going crazy.
No, but I agree. I've never personally done a digital detox because a lot of my friends and family don't live in the same area as me, so the only way to contact them is to text them. But what I have done to get myself to not scroll on online and actually be able to, you know, give myself separation between myself and my work is I've put all of my social media like platforms on my phone in like random folders. So like I have like four or five folders on my phone where it's like stuff I need for like groceries, excuse me, language learning apps, things I need to like pay for parking or travel, and then like stuff related to work, which is a bunch of like photo editing stuff. And I've just like distributed rant my social media apps like throughout those. And then if I really want to go find Instagram, I have to like search for Instagram. So I'm trying to make it not as easy and straightforward for me to just like open my phone and go right to my home screen and be like, ah, yes, the
Yeah.
feet. Which has helped me just being able to be like, okay, is this really, you know, the best time to go in on a TikTok doom scroll deep dive, or is there something else you could do besides, you know, swiping through trying to find everything? And I will say, I know about the search function in my phone. I know I can just like search for Instagram, but I never use that, so I know that I would just like swipe through looking for it.
That's true. That's true. But yeah, it's something that, if you are considering to becoming a digital anthropologist or just be or curious about it, that's something that, yeah, you have to consider trying to create a balanced routine so you don't get overwhelmed and burned out, because it
I
can
feel
get.
like if you were someone with like a lot of funding or, you know, just had a lot of money, then I would definitely say like a research phone versus like your personal phone would probably be a game changer. So if you're, you know, an independently wealthy digital anthropologist who just wants a second phone, I would say in my perfect world, that would be my work-life balance. It would be like work phone, personal phone, and the work phone is turned off Friday at 5 p.m. and turned back on Monday at 8 a.m. But I can still like, you know, order food on Uber Eats.
Try at least for 6 hours to,
Yeah.
disconnect, tell your family, say, hey, I'm gonna be offline. I need a detox. So I'm good. I'm just not gonna be communicating for 5 hours. That helps a lot. But yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. This has been amazing. So much information and, I'm fascinated about your world and, what it means to be you for a day.
Yeah, it's just different every day, but thank you for taking time to talk to me about this. And you know, I always enjoy talking to other digital anthropologists, especially about the future of the field, struggles within the field. And you know, I will tell everyone that if you study digital anthropology, you're a digital anthropologist. Don't let
Yeah.
anyone take that from you.
You are a digital anthropologist.